Welcome. This is Stan Lee of Marvel Comics warning you to look around you, your classmates, your friends. You never know which one of them may be a mutant.
Cyclops, Marvel Girl, the Angel, the Beast, Iceman, and their mentor, Professor Xavier. When banded together, these merry mutants become the X-Men, defenders of a world that hates and fears them. Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters, a bi-weekly show devoted to covering the X-Men saga from the beginning, one issue at a time. With your hosting trifecta, Michael Bailey, John M. Wilson, and J. David Weider.
And welcome, everybody, to episode 6.5 of Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters. I am one-third of your hosting trifecta, J. David Weider.
I'm Michael Bailey.
And I am John Wilson.
And this week, this time around, we actually have a very special episode. We're not going to be covering comics this week. We're actually going to be covering, well, you and your writing and your emails that you sent to the show. And actually, I'm really excited about that. And before we get into that, I do want to point out that while John and I do this show together, we also do another show together now. John, do you want to tell them about that?
Yes. Several months ago, I was invited to start up a show called The Mighty Shield with my friend Michael Kaiser. And recently, he has had to bow out of that show. And when David heard about that, he volunteered to step up and fill that role. So I have changed bosses. And so now David and I are doing The Mighty Shield, a Captain America podcast, where every month we're talking about Captain America in the Golden Age, Silver Age, and today. So every episode we cover a month in the Silver Age, we cover a Golden Age comic, and we cover, starting with the next episode, actually, we're going to be covering the latest Captain America books as well.
Yep.
So yeah, lots of fun stuff over there.
And speaking of Marvel podcasting goodness, you can also find me going solo on Pad Smash, an Incredible Hulk podcast over at IncredibleHulkSmash.com. And Michael also has a new podcast coming out. Maybe you've heard of it. Michael, would you like to tell the people at home?
Yeah, I decided that I don't like free time at all. And that, you know, I really like Batman. So I decided to start reading through my solid run of the Batman books. So starting with Batman number 357, which is cover date March 1983, I will be 1 month a week for the moment going through my entire Batman run, and you are coming with me. Yes, you. Especially you. Yeah, you know who I'm talking about. Yeah.
And the really hot girl next to you.
Yeah, my wife would love that.
Divorce is expensive.
Never mind the fact that I, you know, love her.
Well, there is that.
Never want to hurt her.
If you want to get all moral. So we all have, obviously we do multiple podcasts. We know that. And I'm actually looking forward to the Batman podcast. I'm loving doing Captain America and the Incredible Hulk podcast. So I'm a happy podcaster right now.
I won't be listening to all shows, just so you know.
I appreciate your honesty.
That's okay, John. I barely know who you are. So.
Oh, I'm hurt. I'm crying inside now.
We at the show here, we want to give a special thanks before we jump into your emails to Andrew Chandler. And you can find Mr. Chandler at andrewchandler.net. He has graciously provided us with the banner you see on the website and some of the art that you see scattered throughout. And he was very gracious, very friendly, a great artist. I love his style. So I definitely want to give him a big shout out. And you can find a link to his podcast, or not podcast, his website. Not everybody has a podcast, at the very bottom of xavierspodcast.com. So thank you, Andrew.
That would be the cue to go into the emails, I guess.
Yeah, that would be the key, yeah.
Okay. Well, I had the first one, which is kind of strange because some of these emails were sent before I joined the show. But the first email is from, hey, look, it's Michael Kaiser. Hi, Michael.
Maybe you've met him.
Yeah, never in person, although I was just a few hours away from him back in San Diego. I told him to, you know, skip work and drive down so we could see Captain America together, but he said no, I hadn't showered that day and everything else, so whatever. He says, it's called Antisocial. I sneaked out of work to go see X-Men first. Okay, you snuck out of work to go see X-Men, but not to come see John. I understand how it is. He sneaked out of work to go see X-Men First Class this afternoon, and when I arrived, I entered the theater only to find others just like me, about 10 or so. Not just like me in the sense they looked like me. There were short ones, fat ones, tall ones, skinny ones. But like me in the sense they were all male, and they were all sitting in that theater by themselves. They were comic nerds. Not cool nerds like you find in abundance today that are accepted because comics movies are cool and because women cosplayers are hot, but the kind of nerds that existed when I was growing up. The kind where reading comics and liking sci-fi and fantasy got you shunned from normal society. These were my people, I could tell. And I got to thinking, that's exactly why the X-Men are awesome. Yes, they are an obvious allegory to racism, and gender identity and probably other things too. He doesn't say that. That's my own editorial policy. Then he goes on to say, but they're also an allegory for anyone who doesn't feel they fit into society, whether because of race, some physical deformity, or because you were a weirdo who grew up in the 70s and 80s and liked comics. As Michael Bailey said on the first episode, the Avengers were the varsity, which, as everyone knows, is the mortal enemy of the vintage nerd. But the X-Men were the guys hanging out under the bleachers, smoking, and wanting nothing to do with the pep rally that wanted nothing to do with them. If you were reading comics when X-Men was in its heyday, there was nothing misfit about you, and latching onto characters that also felt socially unaccepted was a fairly easy thing to do. Anyway, loved the first episode. I haven't read many of the early, quote, pre-Wolverine X-Men tales, so I'm looking forward to using your show as an excuse to read about them and follow along with you guys on your journey. Yes, this comic podcasting thing has got so bad that even as a listener, you can't read a comic book without having a podcast to go along with it. All the best for your success, Mike. P.S. Who is your favorite X-Man from the original team?
Ooh.
That was an amazing email, and I've never heard you be so eloquent, Michael. I'm actually rather amazed. That's a really, really cool email.
Well, what about his question? Who is your favorite X-Man from this era?
I would be torn between Jean Grey and the Beast.
Oh,
like, not
choice.
Physically, but...
Yeah, I think
oh,
physically...
Come on.
Don't knock it until you try it.
Those manly hands. I mean, he's kind of sexy.
Should I expound upon my choice? Or is my... Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
Mainly because I like Jean Grey's... I like her power set. I like some of the stories that get told about her. She's one of the few characters in the original team that actually does unique things over the 66 issues. And plus who she becomes later is just really, really cool. The Beast, because he's fronting. We find out later that this whole intellectualist thing that he has going on is a front, because he's socially awkward and doesn't know what to do with his body and his brain. So he puts on the vocabulary thing as a social mask, and I just find that really intriguing.
I can see that. And what about you, Mike? Who's your favorite?
It's kind of hard because there are things I hate about every single one of them. I'd probably have to go with the Beast as well, simply because he's the only one I would want to hang out with, which is kind of funny because he's just, you know, he's just like Reed Richards in vocabulary. But, you know, Scott's always depressed. Jean has too many guys chasing after her. Warren's kind of stuck up, and Bobby would just annoy the crap out of me. So, that kind of leaves the Beast. So he is the less of five evils.
And actually, I would go with Cyclops because somebody pointed out he's the Captain America of the X-Men. Not at the moment.
Yeah, I was about to say eventually.
Eventually, yes. So and that's kind of the Cyclops I grew to know. So I'm gonna go Cyclops.
Xavier, I would imagine, would maybe some people's first choice, but I decided that Xavier is one of the creepiest and worst people to be leading this team in the history of comics.
But he's got a lot of money, so...
He has a lot of money, yes. From those 7 years captaining a starship. But,
Not to mention the residuals from the syndication, because he cut a really sweet deal when he signed that contract.
But he's still got to dodge calls from Jonathan Frakes. Hey, I'm doing a new librarian movie. What are you doing?
Poor Jonathan Frakes. Wasn't he doing like Ripley's Believe It or Not
at 11 o'clock on cable once? Beyond belief. Factor fiction.
So it's not even a real. Yeah, Dean Cain was doing.
Yeah, I was Ripley's. About to say Dean Cain.
Anyway,
did Ripley's Believe It or Not?
I've got
and the two would meet in a season 3 episode of Lois and Clark. There you go.
Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
I've got the next email, which is from Andrew Leyland, and Andrew writes, "Hi guys, great first episode. I'm not the biggest X-Men fan in the world. In parentheses, read the book from around the 170s to the 210s as a kid, but I do have all the essentials from Giant Size 1 to Essential 9. However, I am a big fan of Marvel in this era, and I've never really dug into the X-Men, so it seems like a good place to start. And I have the first two Masterworks in softcover. I'm looking forward to reading along with you guys." Thank you. We enjoy it, too. He goes on to say, "I really enjoyed the setup for the first show and the contextualization you've given to the stories. But what really made me happy was the defense of Stan the Man. It really pisses me off when people, parentheses, and I've seen some pros do it as well, diss on Stan's work without A, taking into account the times it was written, and B, comparing it to other comics at the time. Stan and Jack and Steve were true pioneers in the comics field, and it's nice to see you guys recognize that. Is some of Stan's stuff worth poking fun at? Sure. I just witnessed the ribbing his Betty Brant gets on Amazing Spider-Man Classics. That's funny stuff. Cha-ching! But let's also pay the man his dues. It may have been introduced to comics from other sources, but Stan Lee kept me reading them. Best wishes, and if you want to shoot me a promo, I'd be happy to include it in our show." I probably need to do that. That's Andrew Leyland from Hey Kids Comics. Hello, Andrew. And if you aren't listening
fantastic
to Hey Kids...
Fantastic show.
Yeah, if you aren't listening,
love
you should
that
be.
Show.
And the show's at apleyland.podomatic.com.
Yep.
Yep, that was coming up. But yeah, I'm glad... I felt like, yeah, Stan Lee deserves defense. I mean, he does get a lot of crap thrown at him. And like he said... Take it in context. Comics were turning a corner at this point, and he's the one that took it around the corner.
And I'm glad that you're taking our comments on Amazing Spider-Man Classics in the spirit they're intended, because we love Stan Lee. It's just, you know, the characters he gave us, the females are so... if they were taken to be as real people... they'd be hideous human beings, which makes them really fun to read and really great stuff to read, but we also have to tear them apart.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's part of the fun of this. And we're doing it, just to clarify, because this is something that came up on Walking Dorks recently, because we did a whole episode griping about people griping about comics. When we do it, at least on this show and on Amazing Spider-Man Classics, or even from Crisis to Crisis, it's done... As part of enjoying the comic. We're laughing with the comic, not always griping about the comic.
Well, the thing about Andy's email that struck me is he used a term that that I think really needs to be in more comic book readers' vocabulary, and that's contextualization. I think too often when modern day readers go through a book that is 20, 30, 40, 70 years old, they bring with them a lot of the baggage of what they consider to be a good comic book story and all that. I mean, there are things you can't help but to look at and shake your head at. You know, John deals with this every week when he reads a Tex Thompson story on Golden Age Superman, when you have an African-American character who's drawn to look like a monkey, basically. You know, that you can kind of shake your head at and like poke fun at and think, God, what awful people. But even but to a certain extent, you have to go, well, what were the times that this was written in, and was it socially acceptable? And apparently, oh yeah, it was. But
well, look at Will Eisner's The Spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good, that's another good one.
He has the same thing, and he is considered to be a master. So when you read Golden Age Superman stories, or you read, you know, Silver Age Spider-Man stories, or when you're reading Superman stories from now 20 years ago, you know, it's easy to get lost in what you consider to be the best in comic book storytelling, but it's a little more fun, and you judge the material based on the material it was published with. You know, is Captain America, a Golden Age Captain America story, good? Not because of what I think goes into a good comic book story, but what was good for the Golden Age.
Right.
And what I have found is that while a lot of Golden Age stories are kind of fluffy and light and really not, don't have much of consequence, sometimes they're really damn good. And there's a lot of cleverness in the plot, and I shouldn't be surprised by that, but I am, and that makes me feel bad. So,
and I think seeing some of that really good stuff in there then gives you a feeling for what actually constitutes a bad story of that era. Because speaking of Captain America, you know, there's some really good stories, but then there are some of the second or third or fourth installments in an issue of Captain America comics when you're reading this going, what the hell were they thinking when they put this on the page? And, but, you know, you can't really, I don't know if it's really fair to jump to that conclusion unless you know what really was considered good for that time period.
Yeah. I mean, well, we weren't born then. We don't know the social climate that was there at the time. I mean, obviously it was different. That's a good way, it's a kind way. I know we had institutionalized racism, but yeah, I mean, take it for what it is, because a good example, you mentioned, you know, going back and reading some of those old issues and finding out, hey, these are actually really good. Look at the Fleischer Supermans. For a long time, I thought, well, it was made in the 30s. The quality is going to be, it's going to be shit. And it still beats a lot of the animation that exists today.
Yeah.
So,
and anytime you hear an interview about Superman and someone doing an animated Superman, they're like, we looked at the Fleischer cartoons for so much of our inspiration, because those things are still where it's at.
Yeah. Anyway, I think, Michael, if we have anything else to add.
No, I'm good.
Okay, so you have the next email up.
Who is from Dave Riley. His subject line is X-Men number one. Michael and David, I thought you'd like to know, X-Men number one was also reprinted in Sons of Origins of Marvel Comics in 1975. Also, I have the first issue. To tell the truth, I have no idea how I got the issue.
I have comics like that just kind of appear.
Yeah, but... But, how do you just not know how X-Men number one gets into your collection? Like, I can go, wow, this issue of issue two of the awesome slapstick appeared into my collection. How did this happen? That I can see. Good Lord.
Actually, have you guys ever – well, go ahead. Remind me, I have a question once you finish the email. I'm being rude. Sorry.
He finishes by saying, I love this podcast as well as all of your other podcasts. Thanks for starting a great podcast, Dave Riley.
And thank you for listening.
Yes.
I mean, it's not going to be a podcast till we have listeners, so big ups to our listeners. And you mentioned X-Men number one. Have you ever been in the presence of a copy or gotten to touch a copy?
I have. At San Diego, I took a picture with one. But the light's reflecting right off the slab that it's in, so you can't really tell what I'm holding.
Not X-Men number one, but I was 2 feet from Amazing Fantasy 15 when I was working at the Titans booth at Dragon Con a couple of years ago.
What happened in that issue?
Nothing.
I'm kidding.
Absolutely nothing.
There's this story about this guy on an island, and there's going to be a volcano, and so he rings this bell to evacuate everybody. And then he's the only one left on the island until the angels save him. It's a pretty good story.
Why do I have a feeling you're not joking?
I am not joking. It's the bell ringer. It's in there.
And that man's name was Mo Green.
I think it's a labor story. I'm not really sure, though.
Anyway, but a friend of mine actually had a collection, and unfortunately it's been sold since then, but takes me into his room one day and says, here, puts it in my hand. I'm like, is this for real? And I don't know why I just thought of that, because, I mean, how does that, you're right, how does that pop up in a collection somewhere along the way you had to have known?
But it's okay, Dave, we forgive you this time. Just if you come up with an Action Comics number one, you better have a damn good story to go with it.
Word.
Yes.
Should I read the next one?
Yes.
Yes.
This is a comment, actually. It was posted on the blog posting for the show, which you can find at xavierspodcast.com. And the comment is from Michael Poteet, who says, this is on the episode for X-Men number one. I also liked how Magneto's signature in the air was all in pretty cursive letters. Hey, he's a villain with class. And I, too, was struck, given the fighting for a world that fears them vibe that dominates the franchise later, how easily the army official allowed the X-Men to basically have a go at Magneto, and also at how he wholeheartedly endorses them at the end, how things would change. Yeah, I took the never seen you so fired up before as an indicator that Xavier and Gray have a prior history we're not being told. Maybe that's giving Kirby and Lee too much credit for the first issue, but it's nice to think it's so. I suppose or hope at some point Magneto's complete bewilderment of the X-Men's appearance is explained away, seeing as how if the movie continuity is any guide, and yes, I know it isn't always, he and Xavier founded the school together. It should have been no surprise to Magneto that mutants who would oppose him were being gathered, right? Did either of you think it was weird that the students feel the need to recline Xavier in his chair at the top of page 2? What's up with that? It made Xavier seem like a Christopher Pike-esque paralytic, given that this is the first time we've seen him. Enjoyable first episode, guys. Looking forward to the ride. Since I wasn't there for number one, can I comment on some of these? Well, you were going to say something, Mike.
Well, yeah, the only thing I really was going to say is I don't think that so much made him Christopher Pike-esque. It was when he started blinking once for yes and twice for no that I got a that's like for the 5 Star Trek fans listening to the show.
I got the serious impression, and I think y'all mentioned this on the show, but I can't remember. I got the serious impression that their initial concept for Charles Xavier was complete immobility, that he was just a brain in a body, and that it's not until issue 2 that you see him doing anything with any of his limbs. So I think that them reclining him and everything in the first issue was because of a different impression they had of the character than what they did 2 months later. Did Magneto? I know Magneto and Xavier have a history. Was Magneto there whenever Xavier started the school? Because in the Silver Age Origins of the X-Men backups that we're going to get to in like 15 episodes, or not 15 episodes, 15 months, those have Xavier gathering together Cyclops and the others for the first time, but he's all by himself.
No, it was a huge retcon. That's movie continuity. They had a history, but they didn't start the school together.
Okay. Well, that makes sense then. And as far as fighting for a world that fears them, I think that element really goes into the continuity whenever the Sentinel story is brought in like issue 15 or so, because that's where Trask really starts talking of the anti-mutant vibe on the news. And it's kind of retroactively felt like it should always be there. And you see that in Marvels with Alex Ross and whoever the other guy was. Is that Busiek that wrote Marvels?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So whenever they show the X-Men in that series, it's like they're evil and that the whole world fears them. But I think that's vibe is introduced in the stories with issue 15. But anyways,
it's implied. I mean, obviously Xavier verbalizes it, but you don't really see. Oh no, we did see with Toad when he was at the track meet when they figured out he was a mutant. But it's not as vile.
Oh yeah,
it doesn't become such a big element on the book until around then.
sometimes John will try to say things and sound like he knows what he's talking about when he really doesn't.
And now you know. And,
bum, 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 bum.
Thank you. I was waiting for somebody to take it.
Anyway. That's what I'm here for. That and the dick jokes.
So I've got the next email, and it is from Dave Jones, who writes, "Hi, guys. I wanted to say thank you on behalf of all X-Men fans for this podcast. A chance to revisit stories from the past is something I enjoy immensely. While my X-Men experience started somewhere in Claremont's run, it's a treat to hear older issues and ones I missed covered. Thank you very much. I would also like to present a question to you guys. Do you think Stan Lee was happy with the twists and turns that some of his and Kirby's characters have taken over the years? I was thinking about it as I listened to episode 2. Once again, thank you so much. Listener along for the ride, Dave Jones." In a word, no. Jubilee is a freaking vampire. But that's not his creation, I know, but that's where the X-Men are at the moment.
Dave's a good guy, by the way. I've met Dave. He is awesome.
Okay.
Yeah, he lives on the north side of Atlanta.
That's cool. Hey, Dave.
Unfortunately, hey, I cannot remember the name of the podcast that he was a part of, but he was part of a podcast at one point. And I got to know him through Big Honkin' Steve, so it was really cool that Dave wrote in.
Yeah, thank you.
That Stan Lee has as much emotion invested into the continuing continuity of his characters as we might like to think he might.
No, I don't think he gives a shit about Jubilee, because nobody else does either.
Nice.
Even my wife, I was watching some of the X-Men cartoons, and she's like, "Jubilee's just got the most worthless power on the planet, doesn't she?" And I looked over and said, "Honey, I love you."
Not quite as useless as Dazzler.
Dazzler actually had some oomph behind it when she focused it.
Yeah, but so did Jubilee. I mean, she gave electric shocks, right?
Eventually. But it's they're not even full-on electric shocks.
It's like I've only seen her in the cartoon, so whenever she zaps that arcade machine, that's my understanding of her.
Yeah, it's about the equivalent of putting your tongue on a 9-volt battery.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Now, later down the road, I mean, she is able to focus it and really do stuff with it, but...
Mike gets all the short emails.
Yeah. What is this? I feel cheated. Alrighty, we have our next email from Scott Madman Madsen, a frequent writer from Crisis to Crisis. Magneto's Face sounds like the name of a really crappy like college band. Hey guys, thanks for the fun podcast. You're very welcome. I think you guys said it won't be until the Burn issues that Magneto is seen with his helmet off. Well, I think you're in for a little bit of a surprise sometime before that. I won't say any more so as to not spoil the fun. I guess we were wrong about that, which is possible. I've been wrong about other things.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I haven't read that far ahead.
I think I've only been wrong once or twice. The image I have in my head is of him sitting up on Asteroid M, looking very thinker-like in his chair, with his helmet off, and I think it might be on the floor beside him. It actually looks a lot like the image at the end of Ultimatum 1, but it's John Byrne, and it's in an early issue of his and Claremont's X-Men run. That's what I think of when I try to envision the first time we see him with his helmet off. But I guess there's something before that.
Maybe. We'll find out. He didn't want to spoil the surprise, but thank you for listening to the fun podcast.
Just whisper it to me, Scott. I won't tell him. He's not saying anything, so never mind.
You know, they're out there in listener land.
I'll just read the next email then.
Okie doke.
This is... I like your email there. It's a pretty fun username. I'm not going to share it, though, because of anonymity. He says, it's called X-Men. He says, "Good show, guys. I have one question. When do the X-Men start becoming the allegory for racism? Right now, they don't seem much different than the FF or Avengers. I can sort of see why they took a while to catch on. So when did they become the X-Men we know and love?"
Towards the end of this run, really. Middle of the 66, wouldn't you say? John, wouldn't you'd be able to answer that one a little bit more?
I think that the racism parallel is something that was at first read into and then became more sort of explicitly stated over time. I'm not exactly sure when that started becoming an explicit thing, but I would say that they are the outcast group, whatever outcast group you want to label them as being. They represent that by the end of the Lee and Kirby run, which is the mid-teens. I would say that they're definitely representing that, at least to some extent, by that point.
Okay, yeah, that's kind of where I'm thinking of, somewhat.
But it's a very organic thing, you know.
Kind of like the organic coffee I drank for breakfast. It tastes just like regular coffee.
Exactly like that.
Yeah. And I have the next email. It was also from Roy Bowes, and I do indeed like his email address. And he adds, here's the reason for all the exclamation points. I remember reading this explanation in a Spider-Man letters column from the 70s. A reader once asked, why always an exclamation point? The reason was stated that in printing the comics, the periods a lot of times would not show up in the copies, and it would look like people were talking in running sentences, but exclamation points would print in copies, so they use them instead.
And I believe them. I also have never had a problem seeing, well, not say never, I rarely have had a problem seeing periods at the end of sentences. So,
in comics? I mean, we're dealing with newsprint and a different lettering technique.
I wasn't buying comics in the 60s, and I know that they were printed in a completely different way than they are now, so it could be completely different for them. Just saying for me, I've never really had an issue with it.
You weren't alive in the 60s. Unless you did like
the Clan MacLeod, and I'm immortal.
And every time he says it, guess what happens? He gets laid. I tried it. You know what didn't happen? Guess what? Yeah. Anyway... Michael has the next one.
Alrighty, getting to the next email. Quick correction. This is from Joseph Aland, or Aland. I apologize for mispronouncing your name now. First of all, guys, I love the podcast. The Kirby episode was a strong opening and motivated me to research an artist I always loved but never knew much about. Good job, and the length, an hour is perfect. I have too many multi-hour shows on my podcatcher already. Most of them are probably hosted by me. This is a welcome change. A quick note about Episode 3, the book that Michael mentioned, A Teenager's Tears, wasn't published until 2001. Obviously, it can't be the inspiration for the movie on the marquee in a 1963 comic. Thanks again for the podcast and all the hard work you're putting into it, Joseph. And suddenly I want to sing, go, 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 Joseph, you know what they say. Hang on now, Joseph, you make it some... Sorry.
I want them to put that on Netflix streaming. We were talking about that show the other day. I need to show it to my daughter.
No, I don't remember if I said that that book was from the 60s. It's entirely possible. I say things on a podcast and then immediately forget that I say them. So,
yeah, I don't remember exactly.
Like a lot.
You kind of gave a synopsis of the book, which made me want to read the book, and I'm glad you said that. I will Google that later. But I don't remember if you said the era it came out in. You just said it was an actual book.
Yes.
Behold the power of Google.
Or Bing.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm not going to get in that debate here, but another time. Google versus Bing. This is what we downloaded the X-Men podcast for. Anyway, John has the next one. Next email.
Okay, I have the other Michael Poteet comment that he posted. This one regarding the episode number 3 for the X-Men number 2. He says, another great episode, guys. You've got a good thing going. The Vanisher made me think of Nightcrawler. And yes, J. David, Dr. Evil. I really wanted a BAMF sound effect in the panels. I'm going to interrupt Michael here and say there is no P in BAMF because it is, after all, an abbreviation for badass motherfucker. And like both of you, I was struck by just how accepted the X-Men really are by society at large, up to and including the CIA, and presumably President Kennedy, how things would change. The moral of the story: no weapon as powerful as the human mind. Really comes off as rather chilling, given what Xavier has just done to the Vanisher. And how appropriate does that nom de villainy become, considering his fate? He no longer has a sense of self. He vanishes. Poetic justice on a par with something you might see in Doctor Who. I'm thinking Family of Blood in particular. I could totally hear Patrick Stewart delivering that line and all its rich irony. Maybe I'm just giving issue number 2 too much credit for subtext, but hey, one never knows. It's like when Punisher puts 3 rounds into you and it says something chilling over your twitching corpse. You know, he's just wiped the Vanisher's mind. He's like, yeah, there's nothing as powerful as a human mind. Take that.
Nailed them both.
So I can see what Poteet's doing there. He says, do you think Xavier's projection of the Vanisher's antics is somehow on a par with what Stryker's kid can do in X2? The original Star Trek is also guilty of professionally produced surveillance footage and the like, as the two true freaks often point out. Professionally produced surveillance footage. Oh, because they have their omnipresent sensors and scanners, and they can just bring in video footage of what people have done without actually anything picking up the information. Okay.
Yeah.
P.S. Is it just me, or is the Stan Lee teaser you play a little ironic in warning us that anyone around us might be a mutant, when part of the whole premise is that mutants aren't necessarily to be feared? Just a thought.
I guess it is ironic at this stage in the game, yeah, but...
Yeah, a little bit, so...
I always
thought that intro was funny, though. It's like, look around you. Somebody could be a mutant. And I just picture somebody, like, taking out a gun, going, yeah, you could be a mutant, and then opening fire.
Helter Skelter.
That's wrong.
David, people died. Go think about what you've done.
I thought we were at a rave.
Okay. Wow.
Helter Skelter.
It wasn't put on, you know, the opening just to be ironic. It was, I mean, unlike Superman, there's not really an official X-Men theme except for the one from the cartoon, and well, that one just blew in terms of what we're doing here, so...
Don't candy coat it there, sir. Just tell us how you really feel.
Well, I mean, do you really want a progressive 90s theme to us, a podcast that's trying to take this a little bit seriously?
See, the thing is, I really, really like that theme.
In the context of a cartoon.
Yeah, it's a great theme for a cartoon. It sticks in your mind. It's much, much more memorable than a lot of the superhero themes we've had over the last few years, which I can't remember a single one of the last decade.
I was going to say, yeah, but, hum the Green Lantern theme.
I don't know the Green Lantern theme.
The Great Guardians of the Universe.
Yeah, isn't the Green Lantern theme a monologue?
Yeah. Well, there's the one from the, what is that called? The
old 60s cartoon?
No, the first flight had a pretty decent theme.
Yeah.
I liked it.
Oh, no, I mean, the reason that's on there is I originally did want to use the Pride of the X-Men theme in all seriousness, but it just came off too cheesy.
Well, here's a good question about that. Pride of the X-Men theme.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the lyrics are?
X-Men saves the day. X-Men coming your way.
Okay. Wizard magazine, like years ago.
When there was a magazine?
Yeah. Said it's their day. And I'm like, where the hell is he getting it's their day from? You know? Didn't make a lick of sense to me.
No, it doesn't make any sense.
So I was just wondering how everybody else felt. I like to get other opinions. Even when they don't matter.
Oh,
Lily and I are going to sit down and watch Pride of the X-Men for the first time, right? Before we watch the regular animated series.
Keep in mind that the voice of Scott Summers is Duke from the G.I. Joe cartoon.
Anyway, I should write. I've got the next one. So this is from Luke Giaconetti. Did I say that right?
Try Luke!
Luke?
I love Luke Giaconetti.
And that is, yeah, he says, J. David and Michael and John. Hey, guys, I wanted to drop you a quick line about your new X-Men podcast. Like you guys, I got into the X-Men in the 90s. Albeit a little bit later than the two of you, since I'm a little younger. I read from Uncanny 298 until the middle of the Phalanx Covenant. When I finally gave up on it, that would be the time to do that. Just saying. And during this period, I went in whole hog reading all of the mutant books. Eventually, the fact that I didn't particularly like most of what I was reading caught up with me, and I dropped it. I liked X-Factor, and especially Excalibur, but the rest of it was a lot of hype and not much in the way of delivery. Over the years, I would try to check out the X-Men again, but I never could get into them again. The modern stuff leaves me feeling cold and detached. Oh, that's a good word for it. Eventually, I decided to check out the earliest stuff and read the first issue. Sorry about that. And I really dug it, and from there I read the entire original first-class run and really dug it. I certainly dug it a lot more than the post-Giant Size or the modern stuff. This became my favorite era of the X-Men, despite my favorite X-Man always having been Nightcrawler. That's my guy. Sorry. So I'm really glad that you guys are going to be talking about this era of the book, which normally receives little to no attention and affection. I've always liked the teacher and student dynamic of these early issues, which to me gave it something different from the Avengers and the FF. As Magneto says in X2, I thought you lived at a school. I also really liked that the ages were different. For example, Bobby being the youngest and thus treated like a kid. And this stuff really jives with me, and I wanted to get the three essential Uncanny X-Men volumes, which reprint this entire era. Regarding issue 1, episode 2, this is going to be confusing. Here's a thought I had. On the cover in pretty much every reprint I have ever seen of it, it is redrawn to show Jean attacking Magneto with a jagged telekinetic attack. I really dislike this sort of revisionist history. She certainly makes a good showing for herself in the issue, at least. And I gotta point out, he's absolutely right. I did look this up after reading the email. Every other version of the cover, they've added that after the fact. Which just annoys me now that I look at the original one. It's like, no, she was just modeling. Did you guys take a look at that?
I'm pulling it up now.
Yeah.
Oh, you're right. Yeah, she just... Okay, I could envision what he was saying because that's how it's in my mind. But yeah, she's just hanging out back there, maybe about to do something, and maybe they intended to draw some sort of telekinetic thing. But yeah, she's just... Doo-doo-doo-doo-doo.
Yeah. And then, I mean, look at the Milestone edition. Suddenly they've added
those. That's really strange.
Yeah.
Wow. No, I never noticed that before.
I didn't either until he pointed it out, and I actually looked it up, and, well, what do you know? He's dead on, and that's weird. But it's kind of like the Hulk being gray, and they didn't talk about it for years and years because it only happened in one issue. And they when in reprints, they would actually make him green retroactively, which is kind of disrespectful to history. Anyway, continuing Luke's email, also regarding the characters, still working out the kinks. One of my theories for this is that while Stan was the writer, I think that his attention was elsewhere and that a lot of this book is the product of Jack Kirby. Stan may have come up with the original ideas for these characters, but Kirby quickly took over the reins and evolved these characters into the heroes we know and love. Because when I read the early X-Men issues, it reads a lot like Kirby's solo work, like the Forever People and the like. I think this is a similar situation to what I've read that Ditko essentially was writing Doctor Strange and Don Heck pretty much wrote Iron Man, but that's just a theory on my part. As far as
it's interesting because Stan Lee was on the book longer than Kirby.
True. I mean, this is a debate Michael and I literally blatantly avoided in the first. I believe it was the first episode or second episode or both. Because there's a lot of debate of how much Stan Lee actually put into the characters. But I think it was... my opinion is it was a collaboration across the board. Don Heck, Ditko, it was a collaboration. Stan Lee, and he's never, you know, denied this. He's a collaborator. That's what comics do. Unless you're a writer-artist on your own, you've got to work with people. And I think that's what we saw. I mean, obviously Stan Lee didn't sit down and draw the whole thing himself. So I think there was some Kirby. Kirby had a hand in it, obviously, but I think it was a collaboration overall.
Jack Kirby has often, well, I feel like there's an ongoing debate between Kirby and Lee themselves on who exactly did what way back in the day. And I remember I was talking to my
buddy over at Amazing Spider-Man Classics, Don Grant, about... There was a series of Kirby interviews that were published in a book, and he has so much more credit than he actually had.
The thing about that, and Donovan...
But Lee does that too, so, you know.
The funny thing is Donovan and I had the same conversation. I have an interview from Comic Scene from around 1983 where he just comes right out and says, I never worked with a writer. Now, there's a couple different ways to take that. Kirby is taking credit for everything, which is the most obvious way to take that. Maybe he doesn't consider what Stan did in scripting to be part of what he did with the book. So to his mind, he and Stan came up with the plot, he drew the book, gave it to Stan, and he was kind of done with it. So from that moment on, he didn't work with Stan. Stan just scripted it and put it out there. I was thinking about that the other day, rather randomly.
I can kind of see that.
And there's a silence on the other end of the phone. But you also got to understand, a lot of those interviews, and this is something I never pointed out to Don, which I should have, but I just wasn't thinking about it when we were talking about it. When Kirby gave a lot of those interviews in the early 80s, he was in a pretty bitter fight with Marvel to get his artwork back. So a man who has a bad memory to begin with, because he can't remember what he drew from page to page sometimes, and that's not me being mean, that's just kind of what happened.
Well, no, look at Captain America's shield for an example.
Yeah, so... You know, if he's angry and he's bitter and he's lashing out, that's probably the way he did it. And Kirby did get screwed on many an occasion. So, it's not like a certain other guy with the initials BK who did a lot of the screwing himself. So, it's okay to make fun of him. So,
yeah. But, I mean, there's a long list of comics creators who got screwed.
I believe the term is getting fingered, named after Bill Finger, co-creator of Batman. That's right, I said it. Anyway, going on with the email to wrap that up, as far as Jack Frost attacking Stark Industries and Tales of Suspense number 45, did you know that Jack Frost became the original Blizzard? I did not know that.
No, neither did I.
Touché.
Of course you did. You know everything, don't you? Jackass. No,
I read a lot of that early Iron Man. I looked up Jack Frost. I knew he became Blizzard.
Okay, anyway.
I don't know everything else. I know that part.
Anyways, keep up the good work, guys. I'm looking forward to hearing more of the early adventures of the Children of the Atom. Signed, Luke. P.S. Excalibur has always been my favorite X-Team, especially any time when Alan Davis is involved with them. Maybe I'll start my own Excalibur podcast because the world needs another podcast no one will listen to. Cough, cough. Earth Destruction Directive, cough. You know what? If you made an Excalibur podcast, I would listen, especially if it brings me back into the Alan Davis era. So there's
I'll
one.
I'll go for that.
And Earth Destruction Directive is a Godzilla podcast over at earthdestructiondirective.blogspot.com.
We have got another one, another comment from Michael Poteet. Hey, Mike, what up? Still got to tell you that differences between Superman from the 30s to the 70s and all of those other Superman trades that you asked about like 2 years ago. Not knowing my X history at all, my jaw just about hit the floor when I read about this torch he used to carry for Jean. He's talking about Professor Xavier. Wow. And yes, I agree that Xavier's mind wiping is a bit more serious here than in the last issue. This is Josh Whedon dollhouse-type technology. Ooh. Xavier is planning. J. David, you singled out Grammer and Stewart as good casting choices. Did you not like Ian McKellen as Magneto? And speaking of movies, I do hope you guys will weigh in on the most recent movie sometime.
We weighed in a little bit. I think Ian McKellen goes without saying.
Yeah.
And both Magnetos, McKellen and Fassbender, they owned every movie they were in. I mean, X-Men The Last Stand may have been 80% crap, but all of Ian McKellen was top-notch.
Yeah.
I'll agree with that. I also liked what, what's his name? The guy who played Wolverine. Hugh Jackman did a good job in that one.
Yeah. Except he wasn't playing Wolverine at the second half. Wolverine's never going to be a team player. He's never going to give the inspirational speech.
Yeah, but when you have a bunch of comics with Wolverine in it, you kind of want to... Well, no, you see, I disagree with that, because Wolverine in the X-Men, the animated series that Nicktoons was showing, was, oh,
that was
really
such
good.
A good show.
It was fantastic. Oh, and basically, Wolverine will lead the X-Men when there is no one else there to lead the X-Men.
But right. He's not going to be peppy, and he'll do what needs to be done, but it's not going. He's not going to be Scott. That's what I'm saying.
And here's the thing about that cartoon. That cartoon started at the same time as Iron Man Armored Adventures.
Which sucks.
Now, I kind of like Iron Man Armored Adventures. I watch
Which
it with Lily.
Which sucks.
And we enjoy it.
Sorry,
but
I just
if
wanted
I had to...
to
pick one of the two to survive the cut, like any day of the week, it would have been Wolverine and the X-Men. Far superior show.
And instead, mm-hmm. we get Motion Comics. This is Marvel animation in the 60s again.
With worse voice acting.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is that Spider-Woman motion comic that launched the motion comic line killed the actual comic and still sucked.
Yeah, and I like Spider-Woman too.
I did too.
I didn't like that.
I guess I have the next one.
Who's Spider-Woman?
She's a female clone of Peter Parker in the Ultimate Universe.
Ooh. Awkward. No, really, it was awkward if you read the book.
Next email is from Sandro. I'm going to assume that you have a Hispanic name and are going to go Sandro False. If that's not right, then I apologize.
Oh, look at the big brain on John.
The metric system, what? That's right.
It could be something else, but it looks like Sandro False to me, so that's what I'm going to say. Hi, I like your show. Best X-Men podcast I've ever heard, ever. Just wondering, what's your favorite X-Men movie, and superhero besides X-Men? Keep up the awesome show. Bow ties are cool.
Ooh, bow ties are cool.
But I wear a fez now because fezes are cool.
Favorite X-Men, I mean, not just from this era?
I'm guessing that's what he's asking.
Yeah, Nightcrawler. My favorite X-Men movie? X-Men First Class, I'm sorry.
And superhero besides the X-Men?
Well, Superman.
Favorite X-Men? I'm going to qualify this. Wolverine. Before Claremont left.
So when he was more the failed samurai.
That, and when he wasn't invulnerable, unkillable, had adamantium in his bones, and was it in every freaking book in the Marvel Universe that Deadpool's not in. So,
and half of the ones that Spider-Man's in.
No, really, I mean, the failed samurai thing was fine, but I'm talking more of like, you know, the Claremont Byrne era Wolverine, which I think was kind of a high watermark for that character. I really do like the Claremont Miller miniseries, which I read for the first time about 6-7 months ago. That was really cool. The what?
The 1982 4-issue one?
Yeah. I really liked that. But it's also kind of like but I also really like the Wolverine that was pretty much dying after Kitty Pryde stabbed him, and he just wasn't healing as effectively as he once did. And then the Reavers, you know, crucified him in the desert and left him to die. And after that, Wolverine was pretty much going to die. He wasn't regenerating. He was hanging out with Jubilee because she's underage and that's Wolverine's thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jim Lee came on the book. It got really popular. They did X-Men number one, which I think we should take a moment and commemorate because it's been 20 years since that book came out. Yeah, isn't that? Yeah. but no, I really like that Wolverine. I like the Wolverine that was trying not to be an unstoppable killer, but just at times could not help himself. X-Men movie. God, do I want to see Magneto killing Nazis, or do I want to see Wolverine ripping up people in the X-Mansion?
Okay, say the first one again out loud and then decide.
I don't know, dude. I could have gone for like a 40-minute cut of the incursion on the X-Mansion in X2.
Yeah,
that was the best part of that film, and it wasn't long enough.
Yeah, I remember when I went to see it in the theater, I went with my friend Ryan, who actually is the guy that sold me all of his X-Men comics, which was the start of my X collection. And when, you know, he's wrestling with the guy in the kitchen and he pops his claws in his chest, my normally very kind of cynical, reserved friend went, "Whoa!" really loud. And just from then on, I mean, even my wife loved him killing everybody. And then that scene with Colossus throwing those dudes through the wall. I mean, overall, First Class is a much better film. But man, that X, oh God, X2 is awesome. And favorite superhero besides X-Men, Superman. Come on. Who are you talking to? Seriously.
Bailey is the Superman guy. My favorite X-Men is Wolverine. However, I've also been reading a lot of early 80s X-Men and been taking a shine to Kitty Pryde, not in the way that Wolverine takes a shine to Jubilee. But just, I think that, you know, Claremont wrote her cleverly, and before this time there weren't a whole lot of young characters in comics, like, you know, younger than Spider-Man characters in comics. So to have her there and have her written like mostly a normal human being most of the time was pretty cool. X-Men movie, yeah, it is kind of a toss-up between X2 and First Class. I mean, there were a lot of things I liked in X2. For one, that's when Anna Paquin sprouted, and I was a lot younger then when it came out, so it's not, I'm 32, but I like her in True Blood, so there. But X-Men First Class was just good movie. And superhero besides the X-Men, this is interesting, because if you had asked me this at just about any other time in my life besides the last 6 months to a year, I would have said Spider-Man. I would not have hesitated to say Spider-Man, because Spider-Man has always been my guy. But thanks to somebody whose initials won't be named, but they're Michael Bailey, I have been guided into the world of Superman. And I really like Superman. And now I have a Superman podcast and Golden Age Superman. You should go listen. And I have been spending more time in the last year on Superman by far compared to Spider-Man.
And where can they find Golden Age Superman?
GoldenAgeSuperman.libsyn.com, or search iTunes for the words Golden Age Superman, and there you'll find me.
There we go.
All righty. This is from Frankie Adiego. Says, Xavier's podcast. Guys, this is turning out to be a pretty good podcast. Or should I say, a first-class podcast. Strangely enough, I'm a Superman fan first and foremost. I was actually one of the first kids I knew who even knew who the X-Men were. I mean, I'm a great deal younger than you, but my observation is that while the X-Men were huge in comic circles starting in the late 70s, it wasn't until 1991 or 1992 that they got big among kids. I'll agree with that mostly. The animated series had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, and that premiered at the end of 92.
Really and truly, for a lot of kids of our generation, the X-Men were kind of like the gateway drug into comics. It wasn't for me, but I know so many people growing up that they're like, yeah, I picked up the X-Men and then I started reading Marvel and blah, 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 blah. So I'll agree with that statement. When I was like six, I guess, Frankie continues, I had a Marvel coloring book with a section on the X-Men. I might have noticed them in the ads from whatever other Marvel comics someone might have picked up for me, but I think Cyclops was a solo character called X-Man. Cyclops was a solo character called X-Man, and Wolverine was a separate character called Vrone or something. In any event, I eventually read the X-Men part of the coloring book and noticed they were a team. Then, on some trip, my mom noticed the X-Men NES game. Looking back, sweet Jiminy Cricket, that game was horrible.
Oh, God, that's no joke.
But it opened my eyes to the possibilities of the characters. I already knew who Iceman was from an episode of Spider-Man as Amazing Friends my mom taped, though at some point I was under the impression that he and Silver Surfer were the same character. I was proven wrong, obviously, by this game. I'm guessing that was about 1990, but it was definitely 1991 that I got into comics, thanks in part to a Superman documentary made by Burbank, and thanks to the big old Marvel coffee table book. Oh, that's a great book. But also thanks to the first wave of X-Men toys and their commercial. Remember, a bunch of us kids thinking that the commercial totally rocked, and that was the genesis of my friends and I being X-Men fans. Obviously, the Jim Lee issues and trading cards came soon after, and the cartoons came next year, and well, I grew to vacillate between resenting them because Superman wasn't as popular and loving them because they were awesome heroes with gorgeous hair and gorgeous heroines with a rich history. All of this may seem pointless, but I just kind of wanted to share my experience and to say there's nothing odd about being a Superman fan and an X-Men fan, especially when so many creators in comics and unfortunately feature films have worked on both in significant ways. I am enjoying this podcast, and I think J. David has gotten especially better as a host since the early days of Superman Forever.
Glad I'm getting better than not worse.
The X-Men are basically the Star Trek of comics, except that they came first and had the real McCoy. Okay, that was lame. That was Frankie. That wasn't me, by the way. Sincerely, Frankly Adiego, P.S. I, too, wish Superman had a better rogues gallery. If only he had villains like Lex Luthor, Brainiac, Bizarro, Metallo, the Parasite, Darkseid, the Eradicator, Doomsday, the Cyborg, Superman, and... Oh, you're just being pissy now, Frankie.
And next one up is from Kenneth Laster. I know him from Facebook. And I believe he's going to be doing a Doctor Who podcast at some point. If that's true, Kenneth, drop us a line, give us a promo. We could probably fit it in somewhere. And he says, "Dear Michael, J. David, and John, just wanted to say that you guys are doing an amazing job, or should I say astonishing, or uncanny, or some other titular, I can't even say that word. Is it titular?
Yeah, titular, that's exactly
right. Titular adjective. Just saying, I can't wait for more episodes. Your loyal Hound fan, Kenneth Laster." Thank you, Kenneth. We're looking forward to more, too.
Yay!
I don't have anything creative to say on that, I won't lie. Sometimes you go to the well and the well is dry.
Yeah. I know Kenneth on Facebook too.
Yep.
Episode 5 feedback. On I'm as Kenneth also pointed out. It's just fun whenever we get to the emails where I'm actually part of the show. Maybe together you and J. David can keep this Bailey guy in line. As Michael says, I imagine that what Cyclops was doing while the other X-Men were having downtime was indeed something so incredibly boring that we don't need to see it. He's either sitting in his room alone, sitting in his room reading, or sitting in his room lamenting that he can't ever get close to Jean. And I'm saying this as a Cyclops fan. I like Toad, but part of that comes from the way he would be developed later more than what is actually on panel in these early stories. Still, he's a neat character because he's different than most any of the other early Marvel baddies, most of whom were megalomaniac types. He was one of the first real wormy bad guys in the Marvel Universe. Everyone loves Hypnocoin.
All hail the Hypnocoin.
Keep up the good work, guys. Luke.
Thank you, Luke. I guess that puts me up for our last email for this episode.
Woohoo!
It's also from Luke Giaconetti, and it is New York Geography in Episode 6. He says, "Guys, a real quick note about the New York Geography in Episode 6. If you want to get from Westchester County to any one of the boroughs besides Manhattan, you would have to change trains. You could take the Metro North to Grand Central, but from there you would need to change it to the subway in order to go anywhere else besides Midtown. Unless you're going to Staten Island, at which point you would need to take a subway and then transfer to the ferry. Also, believe me, it's faster to take the two trains to get to one of the boroughs in the city than driving. Even in the 60s, driving on the surface streets in Manhattan was a dicey proposition." And this is from Luke, who grew up in Putnam County, New York, which is the neighbor to Westchester, and took the train to the city countless times.
See, you forgot the most important part of this email. Dear John Wilson, who really cares about this sort of thing.
It's not actually in the email, but I was I was hoping that the chips would fall and he would end up reading it.
Well, you see, okay. Never mind. Never mind. Never mind. Never mind.
No, you're fine. I mean, John, you got to understand.
In one of the stories we're going to talk about next time, Amazing Spider-Man Annual 18, the mansion, they can see the Human Torch's flaming letters, you know, trying to find Spider-Man. They can see it from their mansion, and these are letters over Manhattan. And I'm thinking they're way too far to be able to see that sort of thing because, you know, of the curvature of the Earth and everything. But they're in the same county. Like, Newark City is in the southern part of Westchester County, so I don't know if they're actually too far or not. Luke, you should tell us. But yeah, I really like to know about the geography and how it all works.
I just had a that thing you do moment. Luke, who's Luke? When are we getting our records? Thank you. I'm glad Michael got that.
And now that song is going to be dead for the rest of my life.
It's a good song. It's a good movie.
It is a good song.
And it was a good movie.
But that song, it bounces around in my head until I am kind of dead from listening to it. Anyways.
Now that
in my only dreams.
Somebody else owns the soundtrack. That wraps up episode 6.5, the email episode. Next time around, we're going to be looking at X-Men number 6 and 7.
Woohoo!
And Fantastic Four number 28.
Woo.
Until then, stay classy, San Diego. No, I'm J. David Weider. Thank you for listening.
And I am John Wilson.
And I am Michael, and I also thank you for listening, unlike John, who apparently hates you.
I don't hate you so much as I don't like you. No, thank you so much for listening every single time.
We'll see you next time. You can find Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters on iTunes and at xavierspodcast.com. To get in touch with the show, you can drop us an email. The address is xavierspodcast@gmail.com. And you can become a fan of the show on Facebook at facebook.com/xavierspodcast. Until next time, thank you for listening.
Yes, the X-Men have won, but only for now. Magneto is still out there, waiting, planning, plotting the destruction of the human race. But whatever the challenge, whatever the peril, the X-Men will be there!